Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. As a kid, my favorite book was Rascal by Sterling North. It's the true story of a boy who finds a baby raccoon and it becomes his best friend. I've not been as captivated or as mesmerized by a story, especially an animal story, until Chloe Dalton released her new book, Raising Hare. When Chloe, a city-dwelling professional with a high-pressure job, finds a newly born hare, endangered, alone, and no bigger than her palm, she is compelled to give it a chance at survival. Raising Hare is the story of their journey together. It chronicles an extraordinary relationship between nature and animal. Again, the new book is Raising Hare. It is published by Pantheon, and it's a delight to welcome Chloe Dalton to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, likewise.
I was told about this book from an independent bookseller who thrust it in my direction and said, you have to read this. And I'm so glad I did. It's such a beautiful story. There are many places I could begin, but let me start with the one question that just kept ringing in my ears as I was reading the story, which is, was it always your intention to tell the story?
No, it wasn't. I stumbled into this experience. I'm the least likely person in many respects to have raised a baby hare, to have lived alongside a hare. I also had no intention of writing a book. I didn't see that myself in that way. My work involved writing for other people. And so, you know, as the story with the hare unfolds, you know, during the pandemic, during lockdown, and then beyond, I was genuinely just immersed in a sense of enchantment, in curiosity about this animal, in real perplexity about, you know, what is a hare, the nature of a hare, how do I look after one, and you know, what's the character and behavior of an animal that, even though we think we know them very well, they don't live alongside us. They've never been pets, despite living alongside humans in some respects for thousands of years. I was living alongside the creature. I was trying to work out how to care for it. I was ordering up books so I could learn about hares. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was doing all the research needing for a book, but I had no idea that that's what I would eventually do.
When it comes to cool pandemic projects, like, you win. I mean, I think, like, that's the best. That's a cool thing to do.
It was, and made all the more beautiful by being so unexpected.
Yes.
And, you know, right from the beginning, I had the intention that this creature, I just had to look after it for a short period of time so that it could return to the wild. That was my goal. I didn't think of it as a pet. I didn't give it a name. I let it wander wherever it wanted to in the house and garden. And very rapidly, it decided that it quite liked sleeping under my bed during the daytime and lying in my office while I was working, or lying on the windowsill in the evening when I was reading books, mostly about hares, it had to be said by this point. And of course, it was just utterly unbelievable and such an enormous change from my normal life that I felt like I had been given this extraordinary gift by nature, something I'd done nothing to deserve, but was just reveling in, as you say, during a particularly dark time globally when we were all, you know, the future was so uncertain for all of us.
When you were home and the hare would be near you and lounging and watching, was that very relaxing for you? Was that something that allowed you great comfort?
It's such a good question, because I never would have thought it, but there's something particular about the character of a hare, of an animal that's totally independent. They make cats look needy, you know. A hare doesn't come and ask for food or scrabble at your leg or bark. It makes, for the most part, no noises whatsoever. And I quickly realized that I was very lucky that the hare felt safe around me, and that she would choose to rest in my company, and that even when she was big enough to leave the garden, there's this pivot in the story where she leaps over the garden wall when she's 4 months old, and I think that's the end, and she chooses to come back, astonishing me, and then living this extraordinary life between the wild and between my house. And all the time that I had this privilege of observing her, it did produce this incredible feeling of calm, partly because they're semi-nocturnal creatures. They're most active. They call it crepuscular animals that are most active at dawn and dusk, and then throughout the night. So of course, in the daytime when I was working, she would be sleeping, and the sight of a hare asleep in my office while I was trying to go about my daily work was just so miraculous that I went to extraordinary lengths to try to not to disturb her. And I have to say, not only because of the circumstances of the pandemic and the uncertainty we were all going through, but just because there's something so gracious and elegant and dignified and calm in the character of a hare that's actually completely at odds with their reputation culturally. We talk about mad as a March hare, and hares are described as cowardly animals by Shakespeare, and there's a whole litany of sort of rather negative stereotypes of hares out there. And lo and behold, it turns out that they just love to sunbathe. They clean themselves all day long, and they return every day to the same patch of land.
One day you wake up and you're living in a Beatrix Potter story. I mean, it's pretty interesting.
Yes. Well, that's a very flattering analogy. Unfortunately, I can't draw, so I couldn't paint the little animal, but I tried to paint her in words. And you asked earlier about, did I intend to write a book? And I really, the idea didn't come to me until sort of well over 2 years into this experience, when she did this absolutely incredible thing, and she gave birth to baby leverets of her own in my office. In fact, where I'm sitting right here, just behind this curtain behind me. And that, yes, you could say that that was like a Beatrix Potter moment. And at that point, every time the hare did something, when she left and she had the wild at her disposal, but she still chose to come back to rest in the house, I thought that was pretty incredible. Everything she did struck me as remarkable. But when she gave birth in the house and raised her leverets alongside me and tucked them into the bookcase behind me during the daytime so that they would be hidden from sight, then I thought, wow, this is unbelievable. I should start to sort of reflect on this experience. And that's when the idea of writing a book was born.
Raising Hare is the name of the new book by Chloe Dalton and our guest on this week's book show. A couple of things that I'd like to just mention for people who are coming into this story and perhaps are not aware. But one is that you were told from the very beginning that the odds were against you as far as the leveret that you found was going to survive. I think 2%. I mean, the odds were definitely against you of finding a baby hare in that condition who had been not injured but had been gone after by a dog, and just that is a miracle.
It did, and I don't think it owes an enormous amount to me. I feel somehow I was lucky. When it was explained to me that first day by a conservationist that the leveret would probably die, and that there could be lots of different reasons for that, that it had been picked up and dropped by the dog, potentially injured, that hares just don't do well in human hands. They get incredibly stressed as a species. They suffer from this condition called capture myopathy, which afflicts certain species, which means that their heart can just stop out of sheer fear when they're held against their will or confined. So, and also, just the physical, just the trick of being able to get a little bit of milk into this tiny creature that weighed less than an apple. It was absolutely minuscule, and probably only 1 or 2 days old, as I later judged when I weighed it. And so I tried to get advice. I want to be absolutely clear. There'll be people listening who've done even more incredible things, people who run wildlife sanctuaries, who do this all the time, and have raised successfully many animals. The slightly unusual thing in this circumstance was the fact that this was a wild animal that chose to come and go, that had this relationship of coexistence alongside a human. But this, the odds are against the survival of a leveret. And another thing I should say is that these were unique circumstances that led to me bringing in this little creature, including the fact that it had been chased by a dog and it was lying on an open road. In general, if you come across baby hair, baby cottontail, anything, you don't pick them up. You know, they're hidden because their mothers are keeping them tucked away out of sight. So these were unusual circumstances, and I was very discouraged when I was told that the creature would probably die. And I was determined to do everything I possibly could to try to avoid that outcome. I felt guilty. I felt perhaps I'd intervened unnecessarily, you know, perhaps I'd endangered this creature's life in some kind of way. So I had that responsibility, that sense that my job was not to interfere with the creature's nature, was to keep it, to respect the fact this is a wild animal that doesn't belong in a human home, and to try to do everything I could do to keep it safe so that it could return to the wild.
The instincts from the very beginning, though, say a lot. I mean, I understand everything you just said, but the instincts that you have, even the first time that you pick it up, of gathering leaves and sticks and dirt so that you're not touching it. I mean, that's an instinct that you know, and something that is in you. So as obviously it's not rejected from the mother, but also that no other harm can come from it, from your direct connection to the animal.
Well, you mentioned the book that you loved as a child, Rascal, and there were books like that that I loved as a child. There were, you know, those kind of dreams that you have as a child about connection with wild animals or any animal, really. And I think there have been things that I'd learned as a child that I had forgotten that I knew. You know, I obviously had been told not to interfere with creatures in the wild, and I had some notions about the care that you have to take if you have, for unavoidable reasons, to come into contact with a wild animal. And it was the whole experience, you know, since I wasn't, you know, I didn't have pets in my life. I lived in the city. I traveled constantly. I really wasn't sort of living my life in such a way that would prepare me for this. But somehow, rooted in my childhood, I had a few instincts. And a beautiful aspect of the experience was the way it connected me or reconnected with me with my childhood, with that state I think that many of us experience as children when we are just much closer to nature and to our instincts. And there was a lot about modern life, my modern life in the city, which had taken me far away from nature. So this was really, in many respects, a reawakening for me.
There is a line or two in the book about your mother took care of wild animals.
Yes, well, you know, there were moments when we were very small when, you know, I remember my brothers and I, you know, bringing to my mother some little bird we'd found that had fallen out of the nest, and
Right.
she has this incredible facility with animals and a real gentleness with people. And I suppose that's also, you're absolutely right, that's something that I had observed. That's an example, you know, that I'd had in my mind. It's funny, you know, sometimes we end up, you know, the further away you move from childhood, the more you kind of professionalize, more life is about job and family, and you sort of forget there's like a broad hinterland that we all have of all of those influences and all of those things we learn at school or from our family. And I certainly found that even though I hadn't been looking for any kind of change in my life, I loved the work I did and I loved the way I lived, and I thought of it as normal. I have come to realize through living alongside this animal that, you know, that we're all animals. We suffer when we're taken too much out of nature. I'm certainly learning to try to find a better balance in my own life, as is demonstrated by the fact that I'm speaking to you not from London, but from my barn, my home in the north of England, you know, with the hares running outside in the fields.
Couple of things. One is that my mother nursed a baby raccoon, which is why I started reading Rascal. But what was extraordinary to me about your story, after knowing what I went through with a raccoon, was that after a year, when the raccoon decides to go off and have raccoon sex, they're gone. And the fact that the hair stays with you is remarkable for as long. I mean, even again, that is something that is just against the odds. That is a remarkable story.
Well, it's kind of you to say, you know, I try to in the book, I try to describe and to analyze, you know, the possibility that this is a place where the hare has felt safe because she was raised here, and that these are animals that are extraordinarily faithful to place. They have a huge range. They have to range widely for their food and to mate. Goodness knows how far she roams at night. I have no idea, but I suspect it's quite a long distance. But yet, they come back again and again. If you see a hare in a field on one particular day that's lying in the sun, as long as the weather conditions are more or less the same, you can almost guarantee it'll be in the same place the next day and the next day. And so I wonder sometimes, of course, I would love to think that she chose to lie and rest alongside me because of the feeling of safety that she had in my presence. But I think it's also possible that it was the place, this was the place where she was raised, and I am or was this kind of oddity in the landscape that's like inoffensive and doesn't trouble her, and she feels okay around. But it's really about a patch of land. And I converted this barn. This used to be a barn that was used, many years ago to house animals. And I came to realize that I'm, as the human, the interloper, on a stretch of land where hares have probably lived for centuries, if not thousands of years. So when the hare returns, as astonishing as it is, because she has to overcome so many of her natural instincts, which would be to run away from a human, because all we've done throughout the centuries is to persecute hares, I do feel as if it's that sense of her being rooted in place. And her being rooted in place has made me think completely differently about life, Because we're kind of taught to think that exciting things and adventures are always like you've got to get on an airplane and travel. This is an experience that has totally transformed my thinking about my own life and my sense of what's important. And it was just lying at the end of the garden.
When the hare returns and it comes to you, there is a touch where the hare goes up and touches your leg. It goes on her back legs and touches you. That's a very moving part of the book, but my God, I wouldn't have been I would have been sobbing. I mean, it's just a it's a lovely connection, because at this point, this hare has been in your life for a while now. That must just be something that's really beautiful.
It is beautiful. And the other thing I wanted to say about your point about your raccoon disappearing after a year is, and I'm not a conservationist or wildlife expert, so this is just a supposition, but I sometimes think it might be the case that the male of the species disperses. And then the female, in the case of the hare, stays in place. And that's probably some biological necessity so that the male can go off and like enrich the gene pool somewhere else.
Right, yes.
And so I think maybe it was also, I don't know, would the experience have been the same if the little leveret turned out to have been a male? The leverets that she gave birth to in the house, who were a very entertaining presence in the house for a good 6 months before they decided that they wanted to sort of extend their stride and go a bit further afield. But I would come downstairs and they would be like stretched out on the sofa like basking seals. The female of the pair is definitely more attached to the house and garden than the male, who still comes back, but not as regularly, not as the female leveret is here every morning, every evening without fail, and the male is a bit more intermittent. So that's my, it's possible that your raccoon was a male fulfilling his
Yes.
biological impulses, but I don't know, that's just a
Says so much about just males in general.
guess.
I'm also moved, because you talk about the hard times that a hare has out in the wild, and there's a really moving, sort of gut-wrenching section of the book where you talk about walking out in a newly plowed field, where the hares have just been ground up.
Yes.
And that's so striking, that especially, I mean, you're obviously worried about those that you know, but also just that is often the fate of these creatures that you had live in your home.
You're absolutely right, and I found it really moving to reflect on the fact that hares somehow survive and cling on despite the fact that they faced little else but persecution. They're a very important part of the food chain. They're eaten by a lot of different predators, but they also really suffer as a result of modern farming methods. And I'm not naive about this. We need food security, we need to grow our food, we need access to affordable food. But it was really striking to me the fact that because a baby hare can't go underground, they don't live in burrows, they're not like rabbits. If a big piece of farm machinery comes along when a little leveret is young, it just stays in place and it gets crushed. And it's a big part of why in Britain their numbers have declined by over 85% in a century, which is really amazing. In some parts of the country, you don't see them at all. And I sort of feel as if they're the almost the accidental and overlooked casualties of modern life, that if we stop to think about them, we don't really understand the difference between them and rabbits. We don't understand how special and different they are. We don't realize that they are lives that are worth preserving. You know, they're often, I'm sure that it's the same in America, they're often regarded as pests. You know, they need to be shot because they might damage crops. Part of the argument of the book, you know, that develops over time is that sense of these two are special, precious, interesting, magnificent creatures, even if you might think of it as just something small and insignificant. And they're worth protecting and preserving. And I would like more people to have the joy of seeing hares boxing in the landscape, which is the sight that greeted me when I got out of my car this afternoon to come home for this interview. There were a pair of hares boxing just right outside the house. And that's a magical experience that more people should have. And also, you know, for our own enjoyment, but also for the sake of hares themselves, I feel like they need a little bit more consideration than we've given them in the past.
And that's a sense of play for them, the boxing.
So that's it was used to believe, you know, because of how we tend to think about these things stereotypically as societies, people used to think it was two males boxing because that's kind of a male thing to do, and as was considered back in the day. And but actually, it turns out it's a male and a female. So it's what a female does when she's not quite ready to like accept the advances of a male hare, and he's chased her around the field. You see these like strings of, you know, sometimes like up to 10 hares chasing a female, and if one gets too close and she wants to sort of, she turns at bay and she gives them a, that they box together, and it's part of the mating ritual, but the
But
fur really
that's
dries. It's quite impressive.
it's similar though as far as the activity within the house from your hair was like going after the seams of the duvet or of the curtain of finding that and following it and the action that would take place, which I
It's a
found
really good
fascinating.
point. Yeah, I don't know, because I knew so little about hares. I'd heard about hares drumming their paws, and I always thought it was their back legs. You know, that's sometimes how it's described in literature. And actually, this little leveret, from when she was very, very small, she drummed her front paws, and she would drum her front paws on the duvet in the morning. I'd like to think it was to wake me up. I think it's just because it was a lovely soft surface to like jump and leap and play on, and she would like spring off and then race around the house and do it elsewhere. And she would, I would catch her using her paws against a whole manner of surfaces that produced, particularly when they produce like a really hollow noise, like a cushion, you know, something taut or something hollow. She seemed to particularly like, and I wonder in the book, I don't know if this is true, but I had the impression that she might be practicing, either it could be a form of communication that we don't fully understand, or she could be practicing this like use of her front paws that would be useful later on in life to hold off the males.
One of the questions I have, which is less about the story and more about the book itself and a decision, but Raising Hare is a gorgeous book. There are beautiful illustrations throughout it. Having now seen your Instagram, you have these incredible pictures of the actual hare. Although I assume it was a conscious choice by you or someone at the Mighty Random House not to include those pictures within the story itself.
Yes, it was a decision that was arrived at, you know, working with my publishers. It was their recommendation, actually. And what they've done is the illustrator has used photographs of the hare. So every illustration on the book, including the cover, is an exact rendering of the hare as she is. And I love the cover in particular, because when a hare is looking at you side on, because of the position of their eyes on the side of the head, she's really looking at you. So I wanted the reader to have the feeling of what it was like for me when the hare would look at me. So when you pick up that book, the hare is looking at you, the reader. And all of the beautiful illustrations done by this wonderful Irish artist called Denise Nestor, they're all exactly taken from scenes and moments in the hare's life. So when I open it up and look at them, it's not alien to me. That's the hair.
Mm.
That's the hair raising the leverets. That's the hair on the wall. That's the hair cleaning her little nose. Hair spend an enormous amount of every day washing themselves from top to toe, in the most endearing and beautiful way, which actually, even though it's rather wonderful to see, is also part of their survival strategy, because the only way they can stay safe is if they keep themselves immaculately clean. So I've come away from your question, but it's just to say, yes, it was the publishers probably thought that it would make it feel more timeless. You know, if you
Yes.
could see an exact photo of a room, but you could just concentrate on the beauty of the fur, or the sweetness of the animal.
You mentioned the cover, but there's you have a lot about eye color too in the book, and that's a fascinating. There's that amber hue to the eye in that
Well,
illustration.
I'd read, there's the Hare with the Amber Eyes. It's a very famous
Yes.
novel. And one of the things I noticed, was that hares aren't born with amber eyes. They're born with these dark eyes that in some lights look almost sort of purpley, but they're very, very, they look, at first glance, they look kind of coal black in color. And the amber eye only develops when they're a little over a month old, as far as I could tell. So I found it became over time a really useful way of telling the age of a hare that I was looking at, because there's moments in the book where, for various reasons, I'm living surrounded by quite a lot of hares. So this becomes an important point, trying to and on a serious level, I don't claim to be any kind of expert, and I'm still learning, but almost everything that I read about hares turned out not to be true. The sort of the consensus in scientific studies of hares is they say that they are, absentee mothers, because they hide their leverets and leave them all day long. But that's actually a survival strategy, and the mother hare lies a little way off, and she will drive off a crow if it tries to attack her young. I just found it really interesting. This close observation was wonderful for its own sake. It was important to write the book, but it was also a way of coming to understand there's a lot about these animals, which is very, very special, and that I wanted to share with readers.
The book is stunning. It's just beautiful. It's beautifully written. There's so much information, and the way you balance that with a gorgeous story and so much knowledge that you've gained. I can't thank you enough for being with us and for sharing with us.
So grateful to be on your show. Thank you, Joe.
Again, Chloe Dalton's memoir is Raising Hare, published by Pantheon. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on National Productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at WAMC.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.